everyone who loves books. This is Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, debut novelist Emma Flint finds modern parallels in a historic murder case.
And I thought, whatever the reason for that lie, I have to find a solution to it in whatever I write.
Madeline Brolly reveals how her dad's accent helped her become an RNIB talking book narrator.
I think I was asked to do it because the character, the main girl, is from County Down and my dad is from Derry, so it's virtually the same accent.
Robert Kirkwood explores the backstory of one of the world's greatest living scientists.
They are made up of elements created in stars that exploded a long time before our sun was born.
And Jacqueline Wilson tells us about her latest book.
Clover Moon is another Victorian book. It's a time in history I adore writing about.
That's all coming up on today's Read On Air.
But first on today's show, it was recently Roald Dahl Day. So Talking Books Junior, which plays on RNIB Connect Radio over the weekend, is celebrating by playing James and the Giant Peach, read by Roald Dahl himself.
Sponge, Sponge, come here at once and look at this.
At what?
It's a peach, Aunt Spiker was shouting. A what? A peach, right up there on the highest branch. Can't you see it? I think you must be mistaken, my dear Spiker. That miserable tree never has any peaches on it.
Roald Dahl recorded that book exclusively for RNIB Talking Books in 1986, and he even introduced it himself.
James and the Giant Peach was the very first of the 15 or 16 children's books I have written. I wrote it in 1961 in America, some 26 years ago. And up to then, I'd spent a long time, about 15 years, writing only short stories for adults. But by then, I had a couple of children of my own, and I used to tell them stories in bed, and one day I told them one that they seemed to like and wanted more of, and it was about a peach. And so I thought, well, why don't I try to write a children's book about it? And so I did.
That's James and the Giant Peach, written and narrated by Roald Dahl, exclusively for RNIB Talking Books. And you can hear episode one now at www.rnibconnectradio.org.uk.
Little Deaths is Emma Flint's debut novel. A blend of literary fiction and true crime, it has attracted a lot of praise and been longlisted for a slew of awards, including the Crime Writers Association Gold Dagger. It's a skillful retelling of a crime that shocked 1960s America. The case remains unsolved, and many of the issues it raised remain as unresolved now as they did then, as I discovered when Emma joined me to discuss the book.
It's based on a true story, and it's set in 1960s New York. My main character is a attractive single cocktail waitress who's bringing up two very young children on her own, having separated from her husband. She wakes up one morning, very hot, sweltering July morning, to find that the children are missing from their bedroom.
I mean, obviously you're from the UK, and it was a crime that happened before you were born, I'd expect. Yeah. So what attracted you to this particular story?
Two things, really. I read about it when I was about 15, I think. I used to want to be a pathologist, and I was obsessed with true crime when I was young. And I first read about the story about 20 years before I started writing the book. And the two things that stuck with me through those 20 years were, firstly, the image of the character who became Ruth Malone. She's this tiny, petite, slim, very attractive, very striking woman, heavy makeup, red hair, And in all the photographs, she's surrounded by men, big, bulky men in suits, police uniforms, lawyers, detectives. So that was the first thing. And the second thing was when she was interviewed by the police about the last evening and night before the children were taken, she said that she fed them veal and green beans for dinner. And that's not what they found during the autopsy. And I kept thinking, that's such a strange thing to lie about. Of all the things that she could have lied about, why would she lie about that? Because that didn't give her an alibi, didn't get her off the hook. And I thought, whatever the reason for that lie, I have to find a solution to it in whatever I write.
People have written about the case in the past. I think your book is the 10th, and yet you clearly have managed to bring new light to bear on this unsolved case.
Thank you. I wasn't actually aware that there had been 9 others. I deliberately didn't read any other fiction about it before I wrote the book because I didn't want to be influenced by other people's interpretation of the stories. So I read the non-fiction books about the case, which were written by journalists, and obviously I read the newspaper reports, the trial transcripts. I think what's fascinating about it is that there was a lot of doubt around the case. It took 3 trials to get Alice Crimmins, who was the name of the original Ruth Malone character, it took 3 trials to get her convicted and sentenced and in prison. And it seemed to me when I read the evidence that the police fixed on her as a suspect right from the beginning, before they really knew that the children were even dead. So I think any case where there's a little bit of doubt, where it's not cut and dried, and where there's no confession, is always going to attract attention, writers, retellings, ideas about what might have actually happened. And I think, or I hope, what I'm bringing to it is, as you said at the beginning, a lot of the themes that I raise in the book, how women are perceived, how women are judged by how they look, they are issues that I think we're still facing now. If you look at the way that Amanda Knox, Kate McCann were judged, these are women who have been associated with crimes, and they've been judged on their behaviour, on their sexual behaviour, on how much makeup they wear, on how they dress, not on the actual hard forensic evidence surrounding the cases that they were involved with. So I think at the level of crimes, there's still something relevant going on. And there's clearly still a debate raging about how women are judged on how they look and how they dress. I mean, there was a headline not that long ago showing Theresa May and Nicola Sturgeon, and the headline was Legxit, because they were both wearing skirts. That's the kind of headline I would expect to see 50 years ago, and it's still going on. I just find it extraordinary.
The case is definitely very much a case of trial by public opinion. The 2 lines that really stuck with me are Ruth's lawyer's comment that she's the very picture of a scandalous woman, and the chief investigating policeman saying he can smell guilt on her like cheap perfume.
My sense of Ruth was that she was judged, even before the children went missing, she was judged because she has separated from her husband, which is very unusual for the time and the neighbourhood that she lives in. This is suburban Queens. This isn't cosmopolitan Manhattan. This is well before feminism reached the suburbs. She's married to her high school sweetheart, and she lives in a fairly conventional blue-collar neighbourhood. And she's separated from her husband. One of the neighbours says he didn't even hit her. You know, she just wasn't happy. So she's a single mother, but she's not staying home to bring up her kids. She's going out to work. She's going out to work in a bar. When I read about Alice Crimmins, I kept hearing, the question I kept hearing was, how dare she? How dare she want more than to be married with kids? How dare she want more than to stay at home? How dare she? How dare she? That's what I kept hearing. I kept hearing it implied by the newspaper articles. I kept hearing it quoted in some of the non-fiction books that I read. The neighbours were judging her. The press were judging her. The police, in my novel, the police turn up at her door. She's fully dressed, She's wearing makeup. She's wearing her usual mask of makeup. And she smells of brandy because she's had some brandy for the shock because her children have disappeared. And immediately they think she doesn't look the way a grieving mother should look. So she becomes a suspect. And that's the sense that I got when I read the real accounts of the case. There's one reporter who claims when he turned up at the house just after the children had gone missing, he claims that he heard the investigating officer say to his colleague, "The bitch did it." And that was before they knew there'd been a murder. I think that's an extraordinary basis for an investigation, never mind a story.
It certainly gives Ruth in the book no chance of establishing her innocence, and it's left to the character of Pete Warnocky, a junior reporter who's very much an idealist, to try and establish her innocence. Is he a fictional creation?
He is a fictional creation. He's completely fictional, although most of the sources for the story were newspaper reports, so I did obviously use those as the basis for his character. What I find interesting about Pete is, as you said, he's an idealist, and he starts out wanting to write the truth and wanting to make his break in journalism by finding out who really killed the kids. And then he's told by his editor, no, what you need to do is write the story that people want to read, which means you need to give them a monster, you need to give them some sex appeal, you need to play up the money angle, if there's a money angle. And he's pretty horrified by this cold-blooded way of breaking down the truth. He watches Ruth and he decides that he's going to try and work out the truth for himself. But the problem is, as he watches her, he falls under her spell and he becomes completely obsessed. He can't see it himself and it blinds his judgment. And I found his character interesting because as a writer, but also as a reader, his character continued to surprise me as I was writing. He starts out thinking that he's going to be Ruth's saviour, and actually all through the book he judges her as much as any of the other characters do. And it's almost worse because he's blind to it. He thinks he's doing it for good reasons. And he condemns the others. He condemns the policemen and the other newspapers who are so hard on her. And he can't see that his own judgment of her is just as subjective, just as objectifying.
And Queens is itself another character in the book. Did you have a very strong sense of New York of that time? Did you do a lot of research?
I did do a lot of research. I deliberately didn't go to New York while I was writing the book because I didn't want to see New York in the 21st century. I wanted to see suburban Queens through the photographs of the time, especially the photographs that were taken by, that are in the non-fiction books that look at the actual street and the actual house. The actual apartment block where the children lived. And I think lots of people have said that they really felt that the setting was very vivid and very real. And American readers have said that to me too, which is amazing considering that I'm not American. And if that's the case, I think it's probably because I grew up in a suburb on the edge of a city, Newcastle, which is obviously not like New York or Manhattan. But I think when you grow up in a quiet suburb where there's a sense of claustrophobia, there's a sense of homogeneous community where everybody is watching one another. So where I grew up, it was a great place to live as a child. But I do remember if somebody new moved into the street, you would know, you know, not even an hour, you would know if they were married, if they had kids, if they had any pets, where they worked, what kind of car they drove. And that sense of being watched, that sense of houses close together, people not having anything to do but gossip about their neighbours, that's what I wanted to bring to the novel, because I think that sense of being watched and that claustrophobia is really important in the sense of the story, but also in the sense of Ruth Malone, what she's rebelling against, what she's pushing back against.
And certainly you seem fascinated by what happens to characters when great pressure is put upon them, where their breaking point lies, where love turns to obsession or whatever.
Hugely interested in crime. I read crime fiction, I read true crime. I've always read that from being sort of 12, 13. And I think what interests me about it is that when you have a murder, everybody who's involved in that murder, the perpetrator, the investigators, the victims, families, friends, suspects, they are all placed under the most enormous pressure that I imagine you can put a human being under. And that makes people behave in surprising and unexpected and, for a novelist, really interesting ways. I also think what fascinates me about crime is that, I was talking to someone about this just today, we've all had those moments of rage or blind, being out of control. And what fascinates me is, for me, and I would imagine, I hope, 99.9% of the population, we get a bit angry, we might, you know, kick something, and then we move on. What interests me is the 0.01% of people who don't move on, who take that rage and do something really destructive with it, and who merge that rage with planning or greed or lust and commit a really revolting crime. I'm also interested in the kind of mind that can conceal a crime after the fact, particularly in a very ordinary community. I remember reading about the West case in the 90s, where you had a house in a street, very ordinary street in Gloucester, looked like thousands and thousands of other houses around England, and the most horrendous evil things were happening in that house. And, you know, the journalists were interviewing the neighbours and saying, well, yeah, they were a bit odd, but they were just like any other couple. And I think what fascinates me is this ability to cover it up and appear normal. I can understand the blind rage. I can't understand the meticulous planning and the lying. That's what fascinates me.
Did you feel that bringing some kind of closure, even if it's fictional closure, in Little Deaths was important?
Yeah, I did. I spent 6 years writing the book, and I think I needed a conclusion at the end of that period. But I also think it's very unfair to ask a reader to invest in victims, suspects, main characters, narrators, and not give them a resolution. And I wanted, I felt that the real case, the resolution wasn't particularly satisfactory, partly because, as I said, she had three trials before she went to prison, but also I think because the real Alice Grimmins has never talked about the case publicly, it does give you a bit of leeway to interpret how she was feeling, what those years in prison must have been like for her.
The audiobook that I listened to flowed beautifully, and I wondered if maybe you read your work back to yourself, because it certainly reads very well out loud.
Yes, I'm very proud to say that I've read every single word aloud before it went to my editor. I think even though most of my readers will have it on the page and will have their own voice hearing it, it's really important to me that it flows properly, that the rhythm of the words is right, that the prose just sounds right. And I'm very particular about that. That's probably my biggest obsession in writing. It has to be absolutely right. The rhythm of the lines has to be absolutely right. And I can sit for a very long time poring over a single word that isn't right and come back to it 3 or 4 years later and realise why it's not right.
Have you listened to the audiobook yourself?
I have. I was very lucky in that I got to hear samples of the narrator's voices before it was confirmed, so I got to say yes to them. And I think it's fabulous that there's two narrators, that they've kept it male and female. It was really important to me, obviously, that they were American, that they were from the East Coast. And I think Lauren Fortgang especially, she sounds, that's how Ruth sounds in my head now. It's so strange when you've been reading the book aloud to yourself in your sort of Northern English accent, then you hear an American read it for the first time and read it smoothly and read it so that it flows in the way that the dialogue would flow if it was those people speaking it. yeah, I remember hearing a sample of the audiobook and Ruth's voice just came out of my headphones. It was so incredible to hear her alive, to hear my character come to life like that.
Thanks to Emma Flint, Little Deaths is out now in paperback, ebook, and as a commercial audio download. Let's hope it finds its way into the RNIB library soon.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB helpline team are only a call away with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come on this week's show, Jane Hawking on her memoir of her marriage to Professor Stephen Hawking and Jacqueline Wilson on her life as an author. But first, Madeline Brolly has been an RNIB talking book narrator for 4 years. In that time, she's recorded a range of titles, from Kate Moss's The Mistletoe Bride to Twisted by Linda LaPlante. But many listeners will recognise her as the voice of Eleanor Ferrante's best-selling Neapolitan novels. Here's a clip of her reading the first book in the trilogy, My Brilliant Friend.
This morning, Reno telephoned. I thought he wanted money again and I was ready to say no. But that was not the reason for the phone call. His mother was gone. Since when? Since 2 weeks ago. And you're calling me now? My tone must have seemed hostile, even though I wasn't angry or offended. There was just a touch of sarcasm. He tried to respond, but he did so in an awkward, muddled way, half in dialect, half in Italian. He said he was sure that his mother was wandering around Naples as usual. Even at night? You know how she is. I do, but does 2 weeks of absence seem normal? Yes. You haven't seen her for a while, Elena. She's gotten worse. She's never sleepy. She comes in, goes out, does what she likes. Anyway, in the end, he had started to get worried. He had asked everyone, made the rounds of the hospitals. He'd even gone to the police. Nothing. His mother wasn't anywhere.
Kim Normanton asked Madeline how she became involved in RNIB Talking Books.
I had heard from friends who were producers that Talking Books was a lovely place to work because there's a sense of belonging and you get to work with the same faces over again, which you don't often get to do in acting. You often work with a company for a short time and then you move on. Yeah, it's a bit like a family. So it was something I really wanted to do. I also have a cousin who works with guide dogs for the blind, and she encouraged me when she knew that I was training to be an actor. She said, oh, you know, you must put yourself forward and see if you can get onto Talking Books because it's such a great service.
And what was the very first book that you read?
The very first book I read was A Daughter's Secret by Anne Enright, and I think I was asked to do it because the character, the main girl, the daughter, who has the secret, is from County Down, and my dad is from Derry, so it's virtually the same accent. She then travels to Birmingham, and she's surrounded by people from the south of Ireland, and my mum was from the south of Ireland. So they needed someone who could narrate it in standard English, do a Derry Down accent, and lots of Irish ones. So I think that's how I first got my in.
So Rupert, who does the casting quite often, he must have read your CV very carefully to know all these things.
Absolutely, yeah.
So what's your favourite accent and can you give us a little bit of a fling with it?
I do love the Derry accent where my dad is from. I do go into that. It was the first accent I ever did as a child. My cousins were staying and they wanted to know where their sandals were. And I just thought that was hilarious, sandals. So that was my first word in a foreign accent.
Do you feel a bit connected with your dad when you're speaking that accent? Can you hear him speaking?
I can, yeah. I think that's a lovely thing. When you do accents, often people say they have a sentence to help them get in. So they have a go-to word or a go-to sentence. But I think of people. So definitely Northern Irish, I think of my dad, and Southern Irish, my mum, and so on.
And is it difficult with accents? Is it does it take a lot of effort to kind of get them if you've got one in a book that they've thrown at you?
It can be difficult when they're chopping and changing, when you're going from very diverse accents. Often French accents are hard. You know, if you've got a foreign, so to not make it too kind of over the top, too hello, it's very hard. So it's best just to try and give a little colour of an accent sometimes rather than a full-on because it just sounds ridiculous.
So you're perhaps best known amongst our talking book readers for your narration of Eleanor Ferrante's popular Neapolitan series. Do you have to do accents in that? Do you have Italian accents or...?
No, it's just read really in an English accent. I think it'd be very distracting if all the accents, you know, had an Italian... So you just kind of do it as a not fully working class, but it is set in Napoli, very poor part of Napoli. So just a little colour towards that. I think if you go over the top, you're robbing the listener of the experience that a reader gets. You know, when you read a book, you hear things in your head and you don't want someone to make a massive decision on their behalf, you know? Otherwise you're producing it too much. So just slight variations, male to female and so on.
And we heard a little snatch of one of those books just before this interview. So can you just tell us a little bit about what they're about?
I had been recommended these books by I don't know how many people, often women saying that they'd never read books that were so well written about women and women's friendships before. And sure enough, I think it's one of my top 10 books. So it's about the friendship between two girls growing up in Napoli. And they are both incredibly intelligent, one of them more driven, the other one almost more naturally, instinctively intelligent. And it's about how they grow apart, following different paths, trying to extricate themselves from the very male, corrupt, you know, atmosphere of Napoli post-Second World War. It's brilliant and insightful. I think men also would love it just because it's a story well told.
And how many have you read so far?
I've only read the first two, and I'm hoping to be asked to do the third one because I've put off reading it because it's a bit like reading when I read Harry Potter's. I can't wait to read the next one.
And you put off reading it because you want to read it fresh just before you actually narrate it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do they make you want to go to Italy?
Absolutely. I worked there years ago teaching English and working in summer camps. And so I've been there quite a lot, but never kind of relaxing by a pool. But I definitely want to go to the south of Italy and possibly read the third one. That would be great if someone could make that happen.
And, you touched there on your wider work. You've travelled around Italy when you were younger, but you also do acting, and I know you've done radio work as well. Do you have a sort of preferred métier, or do you like a sort of licorice all sorts, a sort of pick a mix of all of them?
I prefer theatre, and I particularly love working as an actor-musician. I play flute and guitar and sing. So I love plays where the actors underscore the music and then they put their instruments down and they come on and then they act their scene. So they're providing the music and the story. And I love that. And I think audiences love to see that as well.
They do that at Shakespeare's Globe, don't they?
They do, yeah. They haven't asked me, though, so I'm
well,
not...
Well, Madeline,
yeah.
Just get yourself around there, girl.
Well, I'll knock on a door.
And do you have a particularly memorable role that you've played that you really enjoyed?
Maybe not one standout role. I love working in rep. I've been really lucky. I've worked in rep quite a lot, where you get to play multiple roles. So, for example, in a summer season, there will be five plays, usually a thriller, some straight, you know, one other straight play, and then farces and comedies. And you rehearse one play during the day from, say, 9 till 5, and then after 8 days, that play goes up. So you're then performing at night, and then in the daytime, you're then rehearsing your next play. So it's absolutely exhausting, but it's a lot of fun. And I think within those, I once played in Lettuce and Lovage, I played Lovage, the kind of she's quite a hard character. Who else have I played? Sarah in Table Manners, and you know, Alan Ayckbourn. He's always great fun to play. But I think the experience of being in rep is a bit like a roller coaster. So I think I've been spoiled. I do like that Licorice All Sort aspect to it, that you get to play more than one character.
Sounds quite high energy. Do you have quite high energy? Do you need quite high energy to do this kind of reading work as well?
Yeah, doing rep is very physical, but I've done that usually in Sheringham, which is next to the sea. So whenever you're tired, you just throw yourself into the sea. And usually my way of coping is to almost get rid of more energy. I like to run. So the hardest thing I've ever found with narrating books is actually the stillness. And I've met people before in the green room. Some of them are actually radio broadcasters. They're professionals, but they've never narrated a book before. And you see them after a few hours and they're absolutely exhausted. It's the level of concentration, and the fact that you are sitting still almost requires more energy than if you were moving about in a funny way. You get kind of like a head fog, and you can get quite a stiff face, funnily enough, just from sheer talking.
Do you ever get very, very sleepy because you're so tired?
Not sleepy, I think because you have to concentrate so much. And the first time I did it, actually, I was sleepy because I was so worried about how difficult it might be that I hardly slept the night before. I was just going through my head all the things that could go wrong, and what if you got stuck on one sentence? But then once you get into the studio, you realise that you're not on your own. You have a producer. So it is a co-production in a way. Do you know what I mean? Even though you've prepped it on your own and you've got your ideas, you do have backup and someone else helping you through it. So it was okay after the first one.
And I know you're a really big gardener, and we're about to come into spring. So you probably don't have a lot of time to read because you're probably planting and things at the moment. But is there anything that you want to read once you've got all your planting done? Or is there anything you're actually reading at the moment on your bedside table?
I am doing a lot of planting and digging. I have to say, yeah, probably just the next Elena Ferrante is really high up on my list.
It's sitting blinking next to your bed saying, give me the green light, please,
exactly.
Rupert.
Exactly. I need to go and speak to Rupert now after this, see if I can do the next one. I also read Serious Sweet by A.L. Kennedy. It was on the long list for the Booker Prize. So the RNIB got all of those out and ready for listeners in time for the nominations. And having read that, I am definitely going to read more A.L. Kennedy because it was fantastic. So that's on my list for this year.
Thanks to Kim and to Madeline Brolly. Her reading of Emma Ferrante's My Brilliant Friend is TB22520. Its sequel, The Story of a New Name, is TB23134. And let's hope that Madeline is called back into the studio soon to record the third book in the trilogy.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
The Moth.
I'm Jay Allison. Join us for more true personal stories told live on stage. No scripts, no notes, no nothing. Each Moth Radio Hour is a mix of funny and heartbreaking tales that captivate and surprise and delight audiences around the world with their honesty and bravery and humor. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Wednesdays from 8 p.m. and Sundays at 11 a.m. on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up soon, Jacqueline Wilson. But before that, whether it's science fact or science fiction, Read On Air producer Robert Kirkwood has a passion for space. One of the world's greatest space scientists is Professor Stephen Hawking. He's not only written books about the subject, but been the subject of some books himself, as Robert discovered.
Today, scientists describe the universe in terms of two basic partial theories, the general theory of relativity and quantum mechanics. They are the great intellectual achievements of the first half of this century. The general theory of relativity describes the force of gravity and the large-scale structures of the universe, that is, the structure on scales from only a few miles to as large as a million, 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 million. That's one with 24 zeros after it, miles, the size of the observable universe. Quantum mechanics, on the other hand, deals with a phenomena on extremely small scales, such as a millionth of a millionth of an inch. Unfortunately, however, these two theories are known to be inconsistent with each other. They cannot both be correct. One of the major endeavors in physics today, and the major theme of this book, is the search for a new theory that will incorporate them both, a quantum theory of gravity.
A clip from A Brief History of Time by cosmologist, theoretical physicist, author, and star of The Simpsons, Stephen Hawking. It's one of many books by him in the RNIB Talking Books library, covering everything from the nature of space and time, the universe in a nutshell, and black holes and baby universes. There's also a biography of his life by Kitty Ferguson, and a children's book he co-authored with his daughter Lucy, called Georgie's Secret Key to the Universe.
The comet shot through the asteroids incredibly fast. Another large rock hit the comet just in front of them, raining down smaller rocks on their spacesuits and helmets. Through the voice transmitter in his helmet, George heard Annie scream. But suddenly, the scream went silent. The noise just stopped, like a radio being switched off.
Comets. Comets are big, dirty, and not very round snowballs that travel around the sun. They are made up of elements created in stars that exploded a long time before our sun was born.
A clip from George's Secret Key to the Universe, read by James Good, with science facts read by Stephen Hawking. There's been a lot of interest lately in the life and work of Stephen Hawking due to the film The Theory of Everything, which won the Best Actor Oscar for Eddie Redmayne. It's based on the book Travelling to Infinity, My Life with Stephen, by Jane Hawking.
We had scarcely gone 100 yards when a strange sight met our eyes on the other side of the road. There, lolloping along in the opposite direction, was a young man with an awkward gait, his head down, his face shielded from the world under an unruly mass of straight brown hair. Immersed in his own thoughts, he looked neither to right nor left, unaware of the group of schoolgirls across the road. He was an eccentric phenomenon for straight-laced, sleepy St. Albans. Gillian and I stared rather rudely in amazement, but Diana remained impassive. "That's Stephen Hawking. I've been out with him, actually," she announced to her speechless companions. "No, you haven't," we laughed incredulously.
Read there by Sandra Duncan, a clip from Travelling to Infinity by Jane Hawking. At the I Write Book Festival, I asked her how close the film was to the book.
The film is squeezing 25 years into 2 hours, so they have omitted a great deal. They've changed time scales. They have rolled many characters into one. Stephen's friends are all in one character called Brian. I don't have any friends at all. As I said, I really lament the fact that my parents don't feature prominently in the film. And they've left out a huge amount of material, particularly all the travels that we went on. And that, I think, is a great shame, not even to give any indication of all those travels, because they were a large part of our existence. Mm. But on the other hand, the film is very beautiful, it's very moving, and emotionally it's absolutely spot on.
Did you see the script beforehand, and did you have any power of veto over it?
The script was sent to me to vet on several occasions, but I didn't have much control over it. And really, all that I managed to do was to correct the fact that the New Zealand scriptwriter had described Cambridge University as a campus, which it certainly is not. Nobody ever uses that term when they talk about Cambridge. And also, the script was littered with the F word. And I said that scientists in those days, scientists now, most university people, simply don't use that word.
Come on, get up.
Morning, Brian.
Stephen, are you aware that you've voluntarily embarked upon a PhD in physics? Hello.
Hello.
Science.
Arts.
I'm a cosmologist.
What's that?
I study the marriage of space and time.
The perfect couple.
One never knows from where the next great leap forward is going to come, or from whom.
What if I reverse time to see what happened at the beginning of time itself?
Wind back the clock.
Wind back the clock?
Keep going.
I don't know how.
Yet.
Keep winding!
Where's you?
I also asked Jane Hawking how perceptions of disability have changed over the years.
I think the change has been tremendous because when I first knew Stephen, disabled people weren't even expected to be out in the streets. So we got a lot of stares from people who couldn't believe that somebody in his condition was out of doors, either walking up and down or being pushed up and down, and then that somebody in his condition was the father of my children.
Has Stephen helped change perception then?
I would think so, most definitely, because he is now an ardent promoter of all those causes that I worked for so much in the 60s and 70s. And he's very encouraging for disabled people.
It's called motor neuron disease. Life expectancy is 2 years.
I want us to be together for as long as we've got.
It'll affect everything.
You don't realise what lies ahead. This is going to be a very heavy defeat.
But I love him. And he loves me. We're going to fight this illness together.
In the film, you, or rather your character, don't seem daunted by the onset of motor neuron disease.
Yes, because I hadn't known Stephen in any other circumstances. Motor neuron disease struck, well, it had begun to strike, I suppose, even before I knew him. I was very shocked by the diagnosis, but I'd never known anything different.
Now, you mentioned earlier about attitudes towards you and Stephen having children. Is disability a barrier to having children?
I think that's a very tricky question, because I think it shouldn't be a barrier to having a family, but on the other hand, the carer needs a huge amount of help if the carer is looking after the disabled person as well as babies and children. Then that carer does need a lot more help than I had way back in those early days.
Good luck.
Hi.
I'm okay.
So, this black hole at the beginning of time. Brilliant. Brilliant, Stephen. Well done, Doctor.
He has pneumonia. The only way he will survive would be to give him a tracheotomy. He will never speak again.
Yes, he will.
My name is Stephen Hawking.
It's American.
Is that a problem?
It has been a great joy to watch this man defy every expectation, both scientific and personal.
There should be no boundaries to human endeavor. However bad life may seem, while there is life, there is hope.
Thank you.
Sorry, did you say something?
I said thank you.
Jane Hawking's memoir, Travelling to Infinity, My Life, with Stephen, or as it's recently been rebranded, Travelling to Infinity, the true story behind the theory of everything, is available in audio and as an accessible ebook now, and the print version is available wherever books are sold.
Thanks to Robert and to Jane Hawking. Do you have a book that you think would expand my reading horizons? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Dame Jacqueline Wilson was just 9 when she wrote her first novel. She's gone on to be the author of over 100 children's books to date, received countless awards, and been the Children's Laureate. Her best-known character is Tracy Beaker, a care home kid, whose stories were adapted into a TV series on CBBC. Dame Jacqueline has never shied away from tackling gritty reality. Many of her characters, like Tracy, are different and lead troubled lives. RNIB reporter Claire Carson met Dame Jacqueline at the Cheltenham Literature Festival, where she was treated to a reading from her new book, Clover Moon.
She had a strange-looking girl with her, wearing the oddest old-fashioned clothes, a floppy white cap, a brown stuffed dress with a white apron, and enormous boots, much too big for her. She pulled a face at me, and I jumped up quickly, feeling like a fool. "I'm fine, Miss Smith," I said, smoothing my skirts hurriedly. "I'm so sorry to have kept you waiting." "That's quite all right. I can see you've been dressing very carefully. You look delightful, dear. That blue really suits you," she said. I felt my eyes pricking with tears. Nobody had ever said I looked delightful before, not even dear Miss Dolly. If we'd been alone, I'd have taken her hand and squeezed it, but the strange girl was staring. "This is Hetty, Clover. I'm sure you two are going to be great friends," said Miss Smith. "So I wonder, listeners, have you guessed? I introduce Clover to Hetty Feather later on in the book, and the two girls don't exactly get on tremendously well at first. But after Miss Smith has taken them out for a really wonderful slap-up tea, lots and lots of cake descriptions there, they are really, really good friends, and I'm so pleased they are."
So may I start just by asking you to tell us what Clover Moon is about?
Clover Moon is another Victorian book. It's a time in history I adore writing about. I got very heavily involved in Clover's life. She's a very disadvantaged child living up a dark alleyway with a large and destitute family. But hopefully it's not a depressing or dreary book. Clover is a very spirited girl. She's very kind. She's a little mother to all her siblings. She has to deal with all sorts of terrible things going wrong in her life, because that's the sort of thing I write about. But in spite of being left destitute in Victorian London, I wave a magic wand and things work out for her. And hopefully children will feel that it's a very good, positive ending.
She has a beautiful relationship with her true sister. You seem to be able to write so beautifully about deep connections between girls.
I love writing emotional scenes, and I do think for girls, you know, close friendships or you know, close relationships with siblings, it matters so much. And I love to write about these sorts of situations, yes.
We won't give the book away, but she does end up with a brand new friendship right at the end of the book. It sounds like it may turn into a whole new book.
I have lots of ideas for the new book, which will be told from another girl's point of view, but we'll also get to find out what is happening next for Clover as well. I like to jump around with my characters and show what they're all feeling. So it's the one disadvantage of writing in the first person, because you're only in that person's head. But I have solved this problem by I'm going to have one book about Clover and then another book about this new girl in her life, Rose.
you talk about jumping around in books, but you're also jumping around in the centuries in your head every morning when you wake up as you write several books. It sounds simultaneously. How do you do that?
Well, I just write one book at a time, but it so pans out that now I am doing lots of publicity events for Clover Moon, and yet at the same time, early in the morning, I'm writing the next book, which is set in 1939, about children being evacuated from London and ending up in a part of the country they've never been to before. And I just think that whole experience is so extraordinary, and for so many people this actually happened to them, and I just don't know how, well, as a mother I would have coped. I don't think I could have sent my daughter off not knowing where she was going to end up or how long it was going to be, but it is a fact, this did happen. Children learn about it at school, and I thought it was a brilliant subject for a book.
Where do the ideas come from?
I think you can't make an idea. I think it just has to jump into your head. And goodness knows how I started thinking about evacuees, or indeed Clover Moon and her story. It's just, you might be doing something really dreary, like, you know, going around a supermarket, buying this shopping for the weekend, or walking the dog, or just something will crop up out of the blue and you suddenly think, oh, that might make a good idea for a story.
You spent a while dealing with the Victorians with your own daughter, it sounds. Tell us how you came to understand more through you and your daughter finding out more together about the Victorians.
Well, there was a television programme that Emma particularly liked when she was little that dealt with the Victorians, and she was a child who loved playing imaginary games, and I quite liked playing them with her, and she was always very crafty. She would always be the Victorian lady of the house. I was the servant and had to curtsy and do exactly as she told me. Well, what 5-6-year-old wouldn't like to boss their mum around like this? And we got a sort of joint passion for the Victorians, and I would just to read aloud Victorian books to Emma, and I even made up our own story together, sort of writing it in turns. And I like reading the Victorian classic novels too, so by the time I came to write my own Victorian books, I didn't really have to do too much research because, you know, I had immersed myself in the whole thing already.
Now, Jacqueline, a real favourite of mine is Hetty Feather. And in her book Little Stars, she actually comes across somebody who is partially sighted. Tell us about how that happens.
Well, I was interested in writing about people who have to deal with particular things. My characters, generally speaking, are not the sort of people that would make, I don't know, sort of rah-rah girls in an American high school. They're always a little bit of an odd one out. And I am very short-sighted myself. And in fact, as I get older and I'm getting cataracts, you know, which I'm going to have to try and deal with, I'm always very conscious of sight. And I've known various people, including some lovely children, either who have been totally blind or have real sight problems. And so I've always been interested in this. And doing some campaigning for the RNIB a few years ago, I met several fascinating families with that sort of very striking white hair and very pale, including a teenage girl who she wanted to be a goth, and it's quite difficult if you're so pale with white hair, but she did manage to dress in an extraordinary way. And so in Little Stars, I feature quite a few people who don't fit the so-called norm category, and one of them is the delightful landlady who throws open her house to all these various theatrical people, including Hetty Feather and her little friend Diamond. And I tried to show what it's like to be this lady, and indeed Nick Sharrett has done a lovely illustration of her in the book too.
Just a little bit about how you started writing. It sounds like you were always absolutely passionate about writing and would hide away to write.
My teenage diaries are quite embarrassing because practically every week I would be writing about starting a new book and how I wanted to make it as an author and all the rest of it. I mean, there were all sorts of dotty books about liking the boy I saw on the bus every morning and this sort of thing. But writing was the constant. And I knew, well, right from the age of six, that I wanted to be a writer. And I was lucky enough to have a break. I got a job at the age of 17 on a teenage magazine and basically can say I've earned my own living as a writer ever since. I mean, for a long time, hardly anybody had ever heard of me, but eventually, I think my so-called breakthrough book was The Story of Tracy Beaker, and incidentally, that was the first book to be illustrated with Nick Sharrett, which has been very happy teaming. And now, you know, it's so lovely to have actually achieved everything that I wanted to do as a child.
And also to go on to be the name of a magazine and then to see your work now on television. Does that make you feel sort of very proud or are you always surprised?
A bit of both, actually. I love it if my work is adapted and it is delightful. But there's a bit of me that's still a child wanting to be a writer, and it seems very strange that I think Clover Moon is my 105th book, that I have written so many stories, but so pleased that I have done it.
Thanks to Claire and to Dame Jacqueline Wilson. A wide selection of her books is available in a range of formats from the RNIB Library. For more information, visit the website at rniblibrary.com or phone the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5. So that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks to Emma, Jacqueline and Jane, and to everyone who's been in touch about your book groups, the titles you've been enjoying and your ideas for books that I should read. Read On Air will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews and author interviews. Simply go to audioboom.com and search for RNIB, where you'll find Read On Air and other great content from RNIB Connect Radio. So, until next week, thanks for listening and remember to read on.